Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very delighted to be talking today by telephone with Lewis Rose, professor of history at Otterbein University, where he teaches in the departments of history and political science. Dr. Rose is also the executive director of the Sigmund Freud Archives at the Library of Congress. He's talking with us today about his new book entitled Psychology, Art, and Anti-Fascism, Ernst Chris, E.H. Gombrich, and the Politics of Caricature, published last year by Yale University Press. Welcome, Lou.
Thank you.
Before we talk about your book, I wanted to ask you about the Freud Archives, since there was just a post that came across my Facebook feed about 2 weeks ago that featured a news item about the fact that the archive is going online, that there's an open access digital form available now to the Sigmund Freud papers. So I wonder if you can just talk about the archive itself a bit and how Sigmund Freud's papers came to be at the Library of Congress, and then maybe we can talk about the digital archive.
Sounds good. The Sigmund Freud Archive, the organization called the Sigmund Freud Archive, was founded in 1951. The original founders were Ernst Chris, Heinz Hartmann, Hermann Nunberg, Bertrand Luhm, and the first executive director, Kurt Eisler, with the support of Anna Freud. And the organization formed to devote itself to collecting, preserving, and then creating access to Freud's papers. The collection began by trying to reach those individuals who had letters from Freud, because Freud didn't keep copies of his own correspondence. So Freud's original letters needed to be collected elsewhere. And the organization committed itself to that. But also very soon, obviously, I mean, with the creation of the goal to collect and preserve, it also needed to find a repository. And the Sigmund Freud Archives approached the Library of Congress to hold the collection and take care of the collection. And the first donation was made in 1952. And the arrangement with the Library of Congress has continued to this day. The papers themselves, what the Library of Congress has in its collection, the Sigmund Freud papers, they're called, have been integrated with the mission of the library as, you know, the library of public record and research. It includes many different types of documents. Still, the largest single portion, the most, are the family papers and general correspondence. But the collection also includes drafts of writings, either in their original or in photocopies, going back to Freud's, you know, papers on the nervous system in the 1890s, through his metapsychological papers, to his work on the Acropolis and Gnosis and Monotheism. And these, as I say, are either in holograph or photocopies. But it also includes documents related to Freud, not necessarily his papers, but say immigration documents, for example, for when he left Vienna, and communication between those helping Freud and, for example, the officials in London. It also includes his pocket notebooks, which were his, in which he included addresses and notes to himself. And also, very significantly, the Freud papers includes the transcripts of the 270 interviews that Kurt Eisler conducted with Freud's family members, friends, colleagues, and patients in the course of building up this collection.
There was a conscious attempt then to build this into an historical record of Freud's life, his personal life, but also the sort of history of psychoanalysis here.
Yes, because the number of general correspondents reaches nearly 600. And also the number of people, as I say, he interviewed, that Kurt Eisler himself interviewed, reached about 270. And so in this way, too, the Sigmund Freud papers provide a sort of wider history of the development of psychoanalysis, or sources for a wider history of that development.
And then would case histories be here also? And would there be private materials that aren't accessible to the general public at this point?
A very small fraction, like one or a few fractions of the material now is closed. And that includes some case files going back to the 1880s from the Vienna General Hospital. That material is closed owing to patient confidentiality policies. Some papers are still closed if it has to do with certain donor restrictions. There are still five interviews that can't be opened yet, although I think we're close to completing that. And also, where the digital collection is concerned, there are sort of copyright considerations which may have entered.
Yeah.
But the collection has now, for several years, been open almost in its entirety.
Interesting that it ended up in the United States, and the Library of Congress was chosen as the venue, because Freud never lived in the United States, did he? He lived in, you know, Vienna and London. And I know there's the Freud Museum in London, I think, isn't
yes.
there?
Yeah. Yes, and they also have an archive as well.
They do. Okay. So
I mean, especially the library, for example, that still remains in the Freud House.
Yes.
Is there? Yes. Artifacts. Very important repository in the Freud House in London.
Yeah, I wonder if that had to do with the fact that he was so popular in this country and, you know, he spawned so many analysts in this country.
I think it had more to do with post-war history,
that
the United States was the place where many analysts had emigrated.
Yeah.
The future of psychoanalysis seemed very closely attached to the U.S., and it seemed that the Library of Congress was the most secure institution with which to place the collection.
Yeah. This new announcement that there's a digital repository that's available to anyone with access to the internet, that's an interesting
yes.
development, isn't it?
The Sigmund Freud Archives, for several years, has been working on that,
mm-hmm.
working on finding a source of funding to carry out the digitization. And finally, in the last, a few years ago, the Polonsky Foundation provided the funding. The Library of Congress undertook the work of digitizing,
mm-hmm.
and the director and staff there carried out the project. Sigmund Freud Archives helped in preparing material, answering copyright questions,
mm-hmm.
and similar questions. The work of digitizing it was undertaken for two reasons: preservation,
mm-hmm.
but more importantly, again, creating wider and wider availability.
Yeah.
And that has been, for almost 40 years, that has been the chief goal of the board of the Sigmund Freud Archives and the executive directors. I mean, it began with Harold Blum and continued with Anton Chris, my predecessor.
Yeah. It wasn't always the case, was it? I know there were stories about Kurt Eisler not allowing scholars in to look at materials and telling them to go study some other genius.
Well, Eisler had his own conception
yes.
of how the archives could best be used
mm-hmm.
and built. And Eisler's importance to the archives can't be underestimated, even in light of those controversies. The scholarly work he did of collection and just locating where all these sources were
mm-hmm.
was remarkable. And by the time it reached the mid-70s, 1970, Anna Freud had made her first very extensive deposit in the collection.
Yeah.
And it had reached the point where the Sigmund Freud Archives had to begin to sort of adopt new policies, more conscious policies toward access. And that's the sort of immediate context of that, those controversies. But as I say, when Harold Blum became executive director in the mid-80s and Anna Freud's bequest of the final collection of papers she had had in London
mm-hmm.
was included, the aim has been to increase access mm-hmm. to the greatest extent. And what's happened, of course, is, again, you know, the history plays a role here, because when the board first wanted to undertake the digitization, you know, preservation was, I think, uppermost on the board's mind, crucially connected to keeping, you know, access available into the future.
Yeah.
But now, the day that the digital archive was opened
mm-hmm.
and was February 1st, and it was the week that the Trump's first immigration ban was imposed. So that creating a digital website had an importance at that moment, which a few years earlier, you know, we hadn't imagined, which mm-hmm. is now the importance to make this archive available to international scholars
mm-hmm.
who might have been prevented from seeing the originals. And this is the very important role of a digital archives. The international consciousness behind it is absolutely crucial. Crucial.
Consciousness is an interesting word here, because I think of reading that I've done on archives. The Freud archive is something of an archetypal archive, if you will. You know, at least, you know, for people who write about archives these days. And I'm thinking of Carolyn Stevens'
mm-hmm.
book. I think she calls it Dust in the Archive and Cultural History. And, of course, Janet Malcolm's book, In the Freud
mm-hmm.
Archives. And then, of course, Derrida's Archive Fever, which is based on Yerushalayim's famous work, The considers Freud as a historian, Moses and monotheism. So I suppose the question here is, does this legacy enter into how you conceive and curate the archive yourself? I mean, you must be conscious of the history here. And this is a something of, you know, you could think of it as the unconscious of psychoanalysis itself, not that there's necessarily any origin here to be, to, you know, to be cracked, of course, which is what Derrida's point was. So does this enter into the way you curate the archive at all, that it's such an important archive as archives go?
My attitude has been to approach it as a historian. I'm not a trained psychoanalyst. The members of the board and the previous executive directors were trained analysts. I'm a historian of psychoanalysis. And my chief concern, being aware also, of course, of that history decades ago, is that researchers in the Freud archives have, in the Freud papers, have a common, reliable, and very wide basis on which to work, in which to share their work and compare their work. And I think, too, the fact that that the Sigmund Freud archives turned to a historian as executive director indicated that shift as well. You know, when I think of the significance of archives and preservation, I think, for example, of Alexander Stiller's recent book on the future of the past. And that this is, you know, they're just very practical questions that need to be confronted here. And I sort of try to keep my mind on that, being guided by that overall issue of what is going to preserve the links between past and future. Because those links, for any number of reasons, have begun to fray in our own day, and they have to be strengthened.
So there is a difference between an historian and a psychoanalyst, then, although both are about memory and recovering the memory and recovering actual memories. But and history is a kind of, you could regard it as a kind of therapeutic endeavor, at least for the culture as a whole. So
I think it's extremely important to our public culture that our public culture be committed to, again, a very open and honest exploration of the past, so that to have that, right, to have that means that the work of preserving an archives or the archival work that I do and those with me on are members of the board of the Sigmund Freud Archives be always connected with what's going on in the wider culture, the wider political universe. To my mind, what led to the controversies years ago can't determine too much how we conceive of what we're doing now. History has confronted us with new questions, and we need to be clear about those. So yes, I consider myself someone who wants to make sure that these papers become as open as they can be within the shortest possible time from now. As I say, we're at the point where they're almost, you know, are completely open, and that it contributes to the work, too, of the Library of Congress in creating that kind of public culture. Yes.
So your book, Psychology, Art, and Anti-Fascism, is about this connection in a way, isn't it, between culture and psychoanalysis? And it's a book about a book that was never actually written, in a sense. So the book exists in the archive, and, you know, statements of intention between the two principals here, Ernst Kriss and Ernst Gombrich. So can you talk a little bit about that book that was never written and your book and your historical project here with Kriss and Gombrich and caricature?
Yes. Yes. The book on caricature that Ernst Kriss and E.H. Gombrich wrote, and which they completed in manuscript form before World War II, was never published as a book. Pieces of it were published in other studies in two articles, one that Kriss wrote, one that the two of them wrote together, and in a very short wartime pamphlet. And the ideas that they had developed there, you know, appeared in others of their work. But the work in its entirety hadn't been published. And that, to me, was a kind of question that I thought could be explored. What I wanted to do in studying it was, of course, bring as much of that original manuscript to light as possible, but to recover the conception behind their project to study caricature, to study the work that went into it, why it experienced, you know, the fate that it did, and how the work changed meanings within different contexts, or how, I should say, developed new meanings within different contexts. I did intend it to be a study of the relationship between, you know, work of scholarship and its wider political and cultural contexts. But I wanted to study that relationship as it developed over time, so to speak. And I thought what the process was, what it was from beginning to conclusion. And I thought that this manuscript, you know, offered that possibility.
So can you tell us about the two principals here then, Ernst Kriss and Ernst Gombrich?
Ernst Kriss was a very significant, I guess you could say, second generation Viennese psychoanalyst, mm-hmm. came to psychoanalysis after World War I, became a very close associate of Freud, mm-hmm. and a leading member of the Vienna Society. In Vienna, he did not come from a medical background, and in fact, he did not even finally get a medical degree. He remained a lay analyst. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of his first sort of jobs in connection with the Viennese psychoanalytic movement was to edit the journal Imago, mm-hmm. which was the original version of the journal that I edit now in the U.S., American Imago. But Chris's interests were very much in the area of what we would call today ego psychology, mm-hmm. but also studies of creativity and his theory of regression in the service of the ego mm-hmm. was a psychological theory that applied in both domains, ego psychology and theories of creativity. Mm-hmm. And he developed that conception in connection with the study of caricature. Mm-hmm. Now, Gombrich, of course, was younger than he, not a generation younger, but a different experience. Chris was born in 1900, Gombrich in 1909. But Chris went through the war, World War I, in a different way than Gombrich mm-hmm. did. And Chris had begun his professional career immediately after the war. Gombrich began his professional career in the early 1930s. Mm-hmm. So there's a decade of difference between them, and it meant some significant differences in historical experience. But Gombrich's interest from, you know, very early on was in creativity, and especially in the study of images and image making as mental constructs or schemas. Mm-hmm. And he understood the history of art as mm-hmm. how such schemas transform psychologically and culturally over time, both as a kind of individual and a collective or historical process.
Yeah. We still read his we still read his story of art here in Art 105. So
right. That he wrote very early. Yeah. That he wrote in the 30s, and it was published later. Mm-hmm. And that, too, that gave an indication of his early interest in what would become his later focus.
Yeah. Was he Viennese also?
Yes.
Yes, he was.
Yes, they both were from Vienna.
So anyway, they both then fasten on this project to develop a theory of caricature, basically. And I wonder if you can talk about caricature, you know, in the context of the history of art and in the context of psychology also here, and why it interested them, and what was the promise of a project like this for them?
The study of caricature was originally Chris's interest mm-hmm. in the early 30s as an extension of his own interest in studying the psychological processes that went into creativity. Mm. And in connection with his interest in the study of images in a broad sense, mm-hmm. not just as masterworks of art, but images more widely. Mm-hmm. And caricature seemed to him, like the theory of jokes had been to Freud, mm. a way to see into psychological processes mm-hmm. that other types of art or artworks didn't allow. And that gave him an early interest mm-hmm. in the study of caricature. He saw in caricature what Freud had called the unconscious primary processes coming to the surface in a more visible way. Gombrich's interest in caricature was similar to that, but not identical, mm-hmm. in that his interest in caricature, again, was in what it told us about the mental constructs from which all art was shaped. Mm-hmm. But there was something they both were very equally concerned about, and that was art as an experimental process. And caricature seemed to provide them a way with which to study art as an experiment, mm-hmm. the process of image creation as experimental. And that conception of what the experiment meant widened out mm-hmm. from psychology into culture and finally politics. And I think that reflected what was happening also in the world mm-hmm. Around them. Their interests reflected a wider context, too.
Yeah. So they were both interested then in Avi Vorberg and his project, right? Which was
yes.
about the development
yes.
of the development of images, the history of images.
That's
really.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And Chris made very early contact with the Vorberg circle in Hamburg after the war, because he shared with them, or was coming to share with them, that interest in a history of art as a history of image making, mm-hmm. But also as a history of art as a history of memory, in some sense. Mm-hmm. And these questions had begun to interest him. And he thought the Warburg Circle in Hamburg had begun to, you know, approach them and research them in a way that interested him. And it was at the same time that he became interested in the study of psychoanalysis and becoming a psychoanalyst. So those overlapped with each other.
Yeah. How does the notion of the mask figure into what Chris is doing with caricature and his idea of caricature?
Well, caricature, as Chris Engombrich described it, was a kind of mask. And that one studied caricature as part of their interest in the creation of masks that people presented, not only in art, but more widely as well. And that here, you know, my reading of it is that the mask was of interest to them because one could see much within the mask, so to speak. What was interesting about caricature as a mask was that it seemed very simple, but the surface, in fact, was full of overdetermined meaning, so to speak, concentrated. And in that sense, all that one needed to see in the mask was present, and caricature provided that. You couldn't see it all at once, but it was all present. And that's, it's not only a different way, I think, of conceiving of the image, but it's also a different way of conceiving of psychoanalytic psychology, and it's a direction in which psychoanalysis was also moving as well.
So does this develop out of anthropology at all, and you know, studies of primitive art, so-called primitive art?
Chris thought it could be connected with that. Chris had a, he couldn't fulfill this project, but he had in mind a project that would be a history of image making going back as far as you could take it. And it would also be cross-cultural, very much following in, as he said, in the lines of, along the lines of Abby Warburg's Atlas. But the images that he would study would be images of children and children's drawing, caricature, dreams. This all belonged to the study of images. After the war, Chris didn't pursue this kind of project. In fact, he didn't pursue any art historical projects after the war. He was far more interested in advancing what he understood as the scientific content of psychoanalysis, which meant he wanted to add to psychoanalysis experimental observations, which meant he became very active in creating the Child Study Center at Yale University. And using direct observation as new methodology for psychoanalysis. And this is what he ended up focusing on after the war in psychology.
So Chris decides to put on a Daumier show in 1930s Vienna, an interesting venue for it, doesn't he? And he does. And your book is in part about that show, yes?
Yes. They started working on the caricature manuscript in 1934. And it was a year after the Christian Social Government of Austria had abolished parliament. And then in 1934 was the year in which they suppressed, the government suppressed the Socialist Party. And Austria was already turning toward a Catholic authoritarian government. And the Austrian Nazi Party had already begun to make inroads. And Chris was very aware of this, also tried to impress this upon Gombrich as Gombrich began to think of his own future. And as they worked on the caricature manuscript from 34 to 36, they not only were interested in interpreting caricature within a wider political framework, but also bringing the work of Daumier to Vienna to demonstrate caricature's political side, as Gombrich himself recalled. And Daumier himself, they saw as that figure, you know, that artist, that public figure, who had brought the experiment with caricature that had been developing over decades and generations into the public political sphere. And more than that, it was Daumier bringing it into the political sphere that sustained caricature as an art by attaching caricature to the sort of critical political and social perspectives and movements of the time. It maintained caricature as an art form. And as they would later write, when they finished the caricature manuscript a year later, they would include comments on what they saw as the decline of that aspect of caricature in the 20th century as caricature became kind of co-opted or incorporated within, you know, advertising or marketing or outright, you know, propagandizing.
So for Chris, is this then an anti-fascist project particularly? I mean, does he think of it in those terms?
I think he does.
Yes.
He organizes it with French colleagues who he wants to maintain contact with. He wants to bring Daumier's critical perspective into Vienna. I don't think he had any illusions about the direction in which Austrian politics were going. But yes, this was a statement.
Interesting that he isn't an out-and-out propagandist, even though he's very critical of Louis Bonaparte, Daumier, I mean. But
yes,
there's a sort of subtlety about what he does that isn't. It seems to me it's in that subtlety that there's the real critique of fascism, in a sense.
That the critique of fascism is a wide one. That is, it's Daumier's art itself, right?
Yeah.
Not just specific messages at specific moments that represent something different.
So I suppose the question is then, the caricature book, if it had been published, what would it have meant? I mean, you mentioned that Gombrich conceives of it as having the potential to integrate culture, psychology, and politics. And there is a kind of humanistic promise here, isn't there?
Yes.
So
yes. The study itself, I think the study of caricature itself was meant to, in the first place, apply various methodologies from psychology, from art history, from political and social science and history, to a single phenomenon, and to understand it from those different perspectives. It wasn't an effort to collapse one method into the other, to give one sole priority. And in that sense, I would call it integrative. It wasn't meant to unify, you know, these different methods in one direction, but to shed this different kind of light. And in that sense, I think it is important to know this project. It's also a study of, again, image making understood as a very kind of open and transformative process. And this too, I think, was part of the intent and part of their response, so to speak, to the environment, in which they lived, which they confronted.
There is a kind of humanistic something there that reminds me of all the discussions we've been having on the show lately about the importance of the liberal arts in higher education and in the culture sort of generally, which always seems to have to do with an open-ended kind of quest, you know, not a totalizing understanding of knowledge there. So the rise of fascism in Europe in the 1930s is obviously an impetus for this project, but it also is its nemesis in a way, I suppose, in the way you tell a story, and that Chris and Gombrich, of course, get taken into the war effort as propaganda analysts for the Allies, and then Chris ends up coming to the United States, and they're separated, and then they gradually sort of go their separate ways after the war. So
yeah, I think the rise of fascism was not necessarily the impetus to the project, but it influenced its development, and very, very soon. But you can see, as I say, the original interest that Chris had was focused on psychology, Gombrich on art history, and as the 30s became more and more dangerous, politically dangerous, they expanded the project to take political issues more and more into account. That might be the way I would describe it. And it took them into, they both sought war work. When they both emigrated to London, I mean, Chris found a position for Gombrich at the Warburg Institute in London in 1936, where it had moved from Hamburg. And in order to get Gombrich out of Vienna, Chris remained in Vienna until he knew Freud was going to be able to leave, and then Chris left and with his family in 1938. It was going to be difficult for Chris to remain in London because of the early policies towards emigrants in London, towards refugees in England. And the BBC couldn't guarantee that he could stay in London. And there was work for him to do in analyzing propaganda and helping out with what the BBC was doing in that regard in Canada and in the U.S. But to analyze propaganda seemed to them to be a very significant contribution they could make to the Allied war effort. You know, propaganda wasn't something for which they had to develop kind of new methods of study, so to speak. It was a form of mental and cultural image making as they saw it, but it was closed, not open and critical. But their experience in studying images, not only as psychological and cultural images, but also within the political context, gave them the basis on which to become propaganda analysts. Chris saw it that, you know, propaganda in its image making side was also used instrumentally, I mean, to serve immediately political purposes, justifying violence, creating conditions for violence. This is how he saw propaganda being used in Germany. And for Gombrich, propaganda, you know, again, represented a schema, but in this case, a schema to which all kinds of politics and all history had to be made to conform. Not an open-ended schema, but one into which whatever was happening outside of the schema had to be brought within it.
That's so interesting. In a way, it's the weakness of propaganda, in a sense.
Well, this is what they hoped.
Yeah, this is what they hoped. You know, I just wanted to ask about analyzing propaganda. I was very struck by that whole world. That there were whole institutions here, Canada, Britain, and I'm sure, you know, the Third Reich also, devoted to thinking through image making as a kind of science of persuasion. And it just seemed to be very interesting that there were these whole sort of bureaucracies set up, and that the Warburg Institute itself was sort of turned into a place where people would consider propaganda, you know, in a systematic way.
Well, Warburg himself had committed himself, had studied propaganda from the age of the Reformation. That was a particular interest to Warburg. Mm-hmm. And as a scholarly subject, propagandistic images had always been of concern to Warburg scholars. Gombrich himself left the Warburg Institute in order to pursue his work as a propaganda analyst, specifically in the war effort. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't any formal connection between the Institute, although the Institute did carry out projects to contribute to keeping up the morale in London and contributing to this sort of anti-fascist spirit or understanding in the kinds of public projects they sponsored. For example, a project on the art of Europe and the Mediterranean and the like. But analysis, propaganda analysis, Chris and Gombrich turned to the governmental institutions, the political institutions.
Mm-hmm. And carry that out. Was this at their impetus that these, you know, this kind of analysis was done, or were people already doing this and they were just sort of drafted
people had
into service?
Yeah. Actually, both. Mm-hmm. Both. People had already begun to undertake this kind of analysis going back into the 20s. Mm-hmm. Kind of public opinion research. I mean, this is the era, the decades in which public opinion research begins. Mm-hmm. And Chris is very interested in the methods of the pollsters, the Gallup pollsters and the like, and what they can tell us. Yeah. He wasn't satisfied that they could tell us a great deal from his point of view. But again, it was a method that one had to be familiar with and one had to know their data. Mm-hmm. And Chris himself in London, when he was working briefly with the BBC monitoring service on propaganda analysis, organized his own monitoring group. I mean, he was there on the ground floor early on or after the war began in trying to organize small groups of individuals. Mm-hmm. And that is how he could recommend that Gombrich also become a member of one of these monitoring groups or join the monitoring service. And Gombrich was very anxious to do so. He did not want to stay out of the war effort, so to speak, in that sense. He wanted to be immediately involved in one of the Allied projects. Mm-hmm. And propaganda analysis gave him the way to do it. Mm-hmm. Gave him the way to do it.
Interesting, given our political situation today, you know, with the media of fake news and propaganda, basically, that what Gombrich and Chris have to say about propaganda, especially fascist propaganda, seems extremely relevant. It makes your book very timely. They're on a number of levels, it's very timely. I mean, we're talking about refugees here, essentially, from, you know, a fascist regime. So, you know, part of Chris's problem is that he can't stay in England, right? But also, in this analysis of propaganda, and that it's designed to create confusion, doubt and apathy with respect to the news, for one. It's a supplement and a spur to violence, and it's essentially sort of faith-based and immune to doubt. So so I don't know if, you know, you were probably writing this book before the election in November, I would guess. But but it must have seemed everything was sort of coming true here. And as far as our own history goes, I mean, I don't know if, as an historian and a political scientist, if you see parallels here, disturbing parallels.
Well, it's possible to see parallels, but it's also important not to exaggerate them.
Yes.
In finishing the book, of course, I was very much struck by comments which they never developed in published writings on the fate of caricature in the 20th century, when it became taken over into marketing on the one hand and pure propagandizing and defamation on the other. And that kind of development, that historical transformation of the 20th century, reflected, especially for Gombrich, I think for Chris as well, a kind of nihilism. Mm-hmm. And a nihilism which Gombrich thought fascism had embodied, had grown out of. And it's that. If there's a parallel between then and now, it's what I would see as the nihilism, a destructive kind of nihilism, within that emphasis on marketing as a way to see the world, relate to the world. Propagandizing is seeing and relating to the world. It's the nihilism within that. that I think concern Chris and Gombrich a great deal.
Yeah.
And there are, yes, there are elements of that. Absolutely.
And they wrote, and maybe it was in the letters, not publicly, about the danger of a peacetime return to fascism in the United
yes.
States and Europe,
yes.
didn't they? So, I mean, specifically.
No, they were concerned. They were very concerned with the need for maintaining the work of anti-fascism immediately after the war.
Yeah.
That creating an anti-fascist political culture in its broadest sense was one of the most important tasks of the immediate post-war period, absolutely.
So I wonder what's gone wrong here, because for all their and our attempts to create an anti-fascist culture, we don't seem to have entirely succeeded. And, you know, I wonder if the kind of xenophobia you see and the cruelty, I sometimes wonder from a psychological perspective, is it in the nature of things? And I'm thinking of, you know, Warburg's Lacan, snakes periodically coming up to involve us in tragedy. I don't know. But is this a matter of the return of the repressed? Are political problems mass psychology? I don't know.
I personally steer away from those kinds of interpretations
yes, yeah.
from political problems. Mm-hmm. I think political problems are political and require political responses.
Mm-hmm.
What I see is the demand of the moment, or one of the chief demands of the moment, is that we have to recreate, you know, shore up a political and civic culture mm-hmm. that the great majority can recommit themselves to,
mm-hmm.
that they can see as a shared political culture. This would be a response to a kind of political nihilism mm-hmm. that we're confronting. And I don't think that Americans have ever confronted that type of nihilistic attitude
mm-hmm.
in their government as they are now. And I think that's taken many people aback. Now, there might be psychological and cultural reasons for that kind of fracturing mm-hmm. of the broader political and civic culture. But the responses, I think, are just going to have to be political ones, either broad organized ones or everyday responses that people make. You know.
Sure. Yeah, ideally informed by culture, I would think, and history.
Yes.
And whatever the sort of creative impulses that Chris and Gombrich were thinking about there, you know, in caricature, perhaps. So do you worry as a curator and a scholar about the fate of the archive at the Library of Congress? You would think Library of Congress in the United States would be the most stable of all places for an archive.
Yes,
you know? But given the fact that you are an historian and you know things do change over time, and we seem to be in a period of change, it must give you a good feeling that the archive is more and more becoming something that can be accessed anywhere, that it is digital.
Yes, yeah, that is a very good feeling.
Yeah.
And the Library of Congress is also facing a moment
mm-hmm.
when it needs the support of scholars and the public, because we don't know what the final budget is going to be, for example, but the proposed budget right now isn't meant to advance the work of the Library of Congress, for example.
Yeah.
Or let's put it this way, it would make it more difficult. But, you know, as I've said, it's as a location for the Freud papers, it is certainly more than fulfilled its purpose.
Uh-huh.
And I think in one way or another, you know, what the Library of Congress works at through its projects, what individual, you know, scholars, educators mm-hmm. work at through theirs, what archivists do,
mm-hmm.
is really meant to keep an interest in the past alive
mm-hmm.
to sustain an interest in our future. And that, to me, would be the sort of broadest political significance that I could describe, political in its broadest terms.
Yeah. I still take comfort in the fact that the archive is there, you know, in the Library of Congress, and that, you know, and at institutions like the Folger Library there in D.C., I mean,
yes.
it does make, you know, our capital into a cultural center. People don't often think of it like that, but it's, you know, it's important.
Yes.
It's an important thing to have it there, I think.
Yes, that people recognize it as a significant part of our civic culture.
Yes,
of a shared political culture. And that is what is being torn at these days.
So I'd like to thank you, Lou, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about the Sigmund Freud Archives at the Library of Congress, and also about your book, Psychology, Art, and Anti-Fascism, Ernst Chris, E.H. Gombrich, and the Politics of Caricature.
I thank you very much for your interest.
Yeah,
I appreciate it, and I'm glad to be able to talk with you.